WILL. Let's take a look at your Champaign-Urbana weather. For the rest of today, cloudy with a 30% chance of light showers expected. It's going to be cooler with a high of only 62. That's a full 20 degrees cooler than it was earlier this week. Northwest winds of 15 to 20 miles per hour will continue with gusts getting up to around 25 miles per hour early afternoon. That should cut the temperature pretty considerably. Tonight, mostly clear and colder with a low of only 38. North winds of 10 to 15 miles per hour and a few gusts up to 25 miles per hour in the evening. Friday, it's expected to be sunny with a high of 65. Friday night, mostly clear and a low of 44. Looking ahead to Memorial Day weekend, on Saturday, partly sunny and a 30% chance of rain and thunderstorms and a high of 67. Saturday night through Sunday, mostly cloudy, 40% chance of rain and a low of 51. On Memorial Day proper, mostly cloudy and a 30% chance of showers. Let's take a look at some temperatures around the state this hour. In DeKalb, it's cloudy and 53 at the moment. In Chicago at O'Hare Airport, it's 49 degrees. In Macomb, cloudy and 61 right now. In Decatur, it's cloudy and 60, and in Peoria, there is some light rain, and it is 56 degrees. In Pontiac right now, it's cloudy and 55. Springfield, light rain and 61. In Champaign at Willard Airport, we're seeing light rain and 57 degrees at the moment, and it is 54 at Friends Plaza in Urbana outside of our studios. You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL.
Support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods on the corner of 6th and University in Champaign, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of foods from around the world, including cheeses, olives, spices, hot sauces, olive oils, and more. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. NPR's Wayne Goodwin spent time with the city manager of Moore, Oklahoma, as officials figure out how to rebuild after Monday's deadly tornado. The city is concerned about everything from threats to public health to hiring contractors who have to haul away big chunks of the town. Here's Wayne Goodwin.
On the drive south into Moore from Oklahoma City, you can tell when you're starting to get close by the mud splatter. Before the EF5 blasted through on Monday, it had been raining hard for days in central Oklahoma. When the tornado initially dropped from the sky, the first videos show it distinctly, trim and white, a perfectly formed little EF1. 15 minutes later, plowing a trough half a mile wide, it was a mud-caked, fat monster, fuzzy, black, and ravenous. Like most everything in town, Moore City Hall is splattered with tornado mud. Big, ugly gobs top to bottom.
Item number 4 is consider adoption of resolution number 76713.
And like many here in Moore, city manager Steve Eady has been through this before. In 1999, another EF5 cut right through town.
You know, it's hard to characterize. They're all terrible and they're all pretty rough. I think this one may be larger just because I think it crossed through a longer swath of Moore than the other one did.
The 1999 tornado completely destroyed 600 homes and 100 businesses. Statisticians say your chance of being killed by a tornado are about the same as being killed by falling out of bed, roughly 1 in 2 million. But in the last 15 years, the town of Moore has been hit by 4 major tornadoes, 2 of them EF5s, the most powerful tornado known to man. How can that be?
If I wondered too much about it, I think I'd go crazy because we have been hit by 4 major tornadoes in the last 14 or 15 years. What is it? Atmospheric or topographic or something that is causing this to happen? I grew up here, so for 57 years I've lived here. We just didn't see tornadoes like that.
Moore Mayor Glenn Lewis made headlines Wednesday when he said the city council should pass a law mandating new homes in Moore be built with storm shelters. Given what the town's been through this week, that may seem like a no-brainer to outsiders, but not in conservative Moore. The city manager offers a mild rebuke to the mayor when asked about the subject.
Obviously, the council will decide that. We've had this discussion after every tornado that comes along and haven't done it yet. We're pretty independent lot around here in terms of telling me what I have to do and what I don't have to do. Home builders, we have lots and lots of homes built here. Home builders are influential.
Amid the Pavlovian media gushing about how the town of Moore has rallied round, has also come some implied criticism about the fact that the elementary schools that took direct hits had no storm shelters. 7 third graders died huddling in their classroom, asphyxiated by falling debris. When asked about that, the city manager says this.
Lives, you can't count the value or the cost of lives, but you can count the cost of construction. It adds a significant amount of cost to construction. The taxpayers would have to determine whether they're going to pay that or not.
But it's hard to imagine, having buried 10 of its youngest and most vulnerable, that the new replacement elementary schools won't have large storm shelters included. Wade Goodwin, NPR News, Moore, Oklahoma.
You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine here on WILL Radio. The system for seeking compassionate release for terminally ill inmates or prisoners with extraordinary personal stories is currently in shambles. A recent investigation found that many federal inmates actually die while their requests are just working their way through the system. NPR's Carrie Johnson has this report.
Clarence Allen Rice operated a leasing company in Iowa for decades, but when the market went south in 2004 and many of those leases plunged into default, a jury found he turned to fraud. Allen Rice was sentenced to about 6 years and sent to a Minnesota prison camp in 2011. But in some ways, his wife Christine says, that was only the beginning of his trials.
He got sick, very sick. And when they get sick, they don't tell the families. And so I wouldn't know why I hadn't heard from him.
Weeks passed, and Christine found out her husband of 4 decades had liver cancer. She asked the prison doctor what to expect.
He said something to the effect, well, if he's alive in 3 months, he'll be very lucky.
The doctor said he'd started the paperwork so that Allen Rice could apply for early release. In the meantime, he got transferred to a prison medical facility near the Mayo Clinic, where the family was told he'd have to start the paperwork for compassionate release all over again. Under the prison rules, Rice, not his doctors or his family, was responsible for filling it out. Michael Horowitz is the Inspector General at the Justice Department. Horowitz studied the program and found it was poorly managed and rife with confusion.
If you're going to tell inmates that they can only apply if they show that they have less than a certain number of months to live, there needs to be some standards in place so that the people processing these papers understand they've got to make the decisions quickly.
Mary Price is a lawyer at Families Against Mandatory Minimums. She says only about 24 inmates a year get compassionate release, despite thousands who may be eligible under that program, including more than 100 inmates who are over age 80.
It's been neglected for so long, and that neglect can translate into real cruelty at the end of the day. It's not intended cruelty, it's the cruelty that flows from a program that has been, for the most part, abandoned and left to run at all different levels, essentially on its own.
Members of Rice's family say they were on their own, too. His petition for early release was denied because, they heard, the warden wanted him to serve more time. Then they muddled through appeals as Rice got worse, while his family members struggled to squeeze into limits on visiting hours. Rice's final decline happened right after Christmas in 2012, when he went from walking short distances to the visiting area to being completely bedridden. His wife, Christine, spent several days going back and forth to the facility.
I wanted to be able to share with my children, you know, Dad's thoughts to them about what made him proud, what he would encourage them to do. I had to memorize it all to the best of my ability because, you know, he wasn't writing any letters. He wasn't making any phone calls.
She drove home after that, only to get a call from the prison doctor.
She called me, and she hadn't been there for several days because of the holiday and the weekend. She said, well, he's changed dramatically since I saw him last. You should come.
Christine jumped in her car and drove 3 hours to the prison. Her husband died that same night in early January, about 3 months after his diagnosis. Daughter Alana Rice looks back at it this way.
A person really is more than just the worst thing they've done in their life. Just because he was convicted doesn't take away all of the love and the support that my dad gave me and my siblings and his church and his community.
The Federal Bureau of Prisons didn't want to talk on tape for this story, but in response to the critical Inspector General report, prison leaders say they'll do a better job of letting inmates know about the program, cut down on how many people need to approve the requests, and start tracking them electronically. Making all those changes could take 2 years. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to WYLL. Well, lots of things can affect the stock market, and one that is a surefire way to do it is news from the Fed. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke told Congress that the central bank is not ready to scale back on the economic stimulus, but he suggested that the Fed may start to pare back on bond purchases if the economy is picking up momentum. Well, after he said that, stocks plummeted. NPR's John Idsey reports.
Bernanke's comments and the Fed's minutes show Fed officials are inching closer to tapering off their stimulative bond purchases. Those purchases currently inject $85 billion into the economy each month. During a hearing on Capitol Hill yesterday, the chairman of Congress's Joint Economic Committee, Texas Republican Kevin Brady, asked Bernanke when the process of removing the stimulus might begin.
At the pace we're going, do you think it's likely these actions will begin before Labor Day?
I don't know. It's going to depend on the data. If the outlook for the labor market improves and we are convinced that that is sustainable, we will respond to that. If the recovery were to falter, then we would delay that process.
There are concerns that reducing the stimulus could undermine the financial markets, which have risen sharply, fueled by the Fed's action. Bernanke eased one big concern on that front yesterday. He said he now believes the Fed can exit its stimulative program without selling off the assets it purchased during its quantitative easing campaign. Selling hundreds of billions of dollars worth of those assets could have seriously disrupted the financial markets. John Idsey, NPR News, Washington.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Strategic Farm Marketing, Champaign; KC Summers, Mattoon; and Jarman Center, Tuscola. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday, the 23rd of May, 2013. It's the birthday of the poet Jane Kenyon, born Ann Arbor, Michigan, 1947. Lived with the poet Donald Hall, her husband, in New Hampshire. Lived there until her untimely death of leukemia at the age of 47. It's the birthday of the woman who wrote Goodnight Moon, Margaret Wise Brown, born Brooklyn, 1910. She believed that kids would rather read about things in their own world than fairy tales and fables. Wrote nearly 100 picture books under several pen names. She was a lovely blonde, had green eyes, a little eccentric, lived on the Upper East Side of New York. At one time, she dated Juan Carlos, the Prince of Spain. When she was 42, she met James Stillman Rockefeller, Jr. He was 26. They were engaged to be married when Margaret Wise Brown died suddenly. She'd had surgery a few weeks before. She was kicking up her leg like a can-can dancer to show her doctor how good she felt, and the kick dislodged a blood clot in her leg, which went to her heart and killed her. She had no children of her own. She left the royalties for most of her books to a 9-year-old neighbor boy, Albert Clark. It came to about $5 million, which he squandered, spending his life in and out of jail, making a series of bad real estate deals. And it's the birthday of the man who, when studying meteorology, gave birth to what became chaos theory, Edward Norton Lorenz, West Hartford, Connecticut, 1917. He coined the term the butterfly effect, trying to explain how small actions in a dynamic system like the atmosphere could trigger vast and unexpected changes. Here's a poem for today by Davy Walders, Anniversary. That you and I and you, this 25th year, after you stamped your foot, shattered the glass, and friends, so many dead or forgotten, applauded in a ballroom long abandoned, 25 years of Monday goodbyes, monthly wars, with stacks of bills, bags of garbage, frozen gutters, nights filled with pink medicines, fevered cheeks on shoulders, the other hand reaching for the pediatrician's call, termites chewing, and hours waiting for the door to open, holding our own daughter's head, vomiting beer into our own leaking toilet, that now, as mirrors mark the descent of breasts, the tub catches silvered pubic hair, and our eyes wear pouches and hoods as though expecting rain, that you and I could smell the salt of each other coming together after long absence, silent, still, staring up at the darkening ceiling, naked in a house with empty, orderly bedrooms, the last of dead roses and discarded boyfriends tossed out, your hand touching mine, our breathing slowing, the wonder of it all.